Hello, and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo, episode 134. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me here tonight, James Jones, the happiest man on Earth.
Fuck you.
Personality plus.
Greg Leahy, the consummate professional himself.
Ahoy, ahoy, everyone.
And John Lindemann.
He's asleep. I'm always on time, even when I'm late, baby.
All right, guys, we got a big show here. We're going to start off, of course, with new business, and Greg is going first.
Okay, well, so it's funny, Johnny was talking last week that he picked up Wii Speak, and right around the same time, I got the Wii Speak Animal Crossing bundle for a very nice deal.
Ooh, we can chat across the Atlantic.
Gee, what a marvel of modern technology.
The Wii Speak channel is installed, although the fact that it's 50 blocks makes it very vulnerable at any time.
Greg,
have you actually looked in the channel yet?
I've mucked around with it. I've just seen, like,
I think it's really nice. I think it's one of the nicest channels they've done.
Yeah, that's what kind of makes me sad, though. You've got stuff like the Mario Kart channel, the Wii Fit channel, and I assume, you know, there'll be subsequent software that'll have a similar sort of thing. And then it's like, with this whole storage issue, it's like, are you really going to keep them around?
Yeah, well, stuff, you know, like the Mario Kart and the Wii Fit channels, they're not really useful. I mean, the Wii Speak channel is a standalone thing.
I would argue that the Mario Kart channel is useful in that you can use it for matchmaking and...
Yeah, that was in terms of you didn't necessarily have to have the game in the actual disc drive to see if any of your friends were online playing Mario Kart.
Well, yeah, I mean, I wish they would have a channel that would just show you who else is online.
John wants Xbox Live.
If they had a unified friends thing, you could have a friends channel or something, but that's the problem, you haven't got a unified friends.
So, Greg, what do you think of the Animal Crossing City Folk channel that comes with your Wii Speak?
Yeah, well, I've never played Animal Crossing before, and this was a pretty good deal. In fact, I think if you have the retail value of Wii Speak off, like, it was cheaper than buying the DS game new. Because that's still, like, ridiculously expensive because it sells so well. So, yeah, it was a nice deal to get it. And I'm not that big necessarily on the portability with a game like this. Because kind of like Endless Ocean and The Blob before it is a kind of nice antidote to my virtual console hardcore head-bashing gaming sessions. it's sort of very relaxing, kind of self-affirming kind of thing to do after Ghouls and Ghosts kick you in the nuts about another six times.
That was a good day.
The game is so brutal. it's nice and relaxing. It's what I would call it's an accumulation game. So it's kind of, I guess you would play it very extensively in the sense that you wouldn't necessarily play it a lot, but you would play it over a long period of time. Or I would anyway. I doubt it'll be as much of a time sink for me as it is for others. And just gradually kind of gather more and more things to use. And there's such a myriad of different kinds of things, you know, whether it's obviously like the possession side, or whether it's like stuff you find in your town, like the fossils, or you can like make your own constellations that show up in the sky, which meant that I immediately did a giant Yoshi in the sky, of course. And it's pretty much delivering what I sort of expected in terms of just something kind of a nice sort of diverse, very different kind of game. And I can see myself playing it little by little for quite a while, actually. I mean, obviously the big complaint about it was that it was so similar to the others, but that doesn't really apply to me, so I can't really speak to that.
Well, I mean, I think for someone like you, it is, you know, it's good for people who haven't played it before.
Yeah, I mean, the one issue that's kind of apparent to me, even as someone who hadn't played the handheld version or any other versions, is that they use that rolling effect, which they use in the DS version, you know, where the sort of the environment kind of scrolls. And, you know, it just feels very kind of cramped. It feels like you just don't get to see much of the town. Right. And considering so much of the game is kind of tailoring the appearance of your town, managing it, you know, the flowers and the trees and all that sort of thing, you'd just like to see more of it, at least have the option to change the view or whatever. So I just think that was a shame.
I kind of liked the rolling. It was kind of a neat little effect.
I wouldn't mind the rolling element so much if it just didn't feel quite so tight in. You know, it feels very kind of, you know, very close. If it was a bit more like you just, you know, it rolled in the same way, but you just saw more you know, in a still shot, like it felt a bit wider out or something, it wouldn't be quite so. It's not really a big deal, obviously, but I just found that, like, it seemed like it was a bit too much adherence to the DS game, perhaps. I mean, it kind of makes sense. The DS game is ludicrously successful in Japan. It's actually sold over 5 million copies in Japan alone.
Holy crap,
which
I think that was
is only matched by, if you put together the Nintendogs or you put together Pokemon or New Super Mario Brothers,
I mean,
it's in an elite class in Japan, and therefore that may well have informed that we really will stick very close to that. And Animal Crossing in Japan for the Wii has already sold over 1 million, which is significantly in excess of what Super Mario Galaxy has sold, for instance.
That's disgusting.
Yeah, so, see, I always thought that on the DS, I thought that they put the rolling in just because of hardware reasons, right? Like, just, you know, to save so they wouldn't have to, you know, render stuff further off.
Well, the GameCube game does that 2D Zelda panning shit, so they wouldn't be rendering stuff off very far off.
Anyway. Is a different way of managing it,
but
yeah.
But see, you know, what happened there, though, was if an item popped up, like, right at the edge of the screen, you could accidentally step over the edge when you go to get it, and that was kind of annoying. I remember that much being kind of a pain in the ass. So that, I mean, it might just been so that it's a continuous flow, so you know.
Yeah,
if
it were just a bit more zoomed out, I wouldn't have a problem with the effect
weird.
Per
it
se.
It was very much. It's always been very tight camera. So I mean, I don't think they want to give you the impression that you're God looking down on them. I think
the camera sort of has to be tight in the Wii game because you can design so many of the textures.
That's true.
You wouldn't be able to see the detail on the textures that you design.
Yeah, I mean,
if the camera wasn't there.
I would quite like just something to maybe, like, you know, you could have the camera as dynamic a little, or you could change it to a dynamic camera, or perhaps just you could have somewhere where you could go to sort of like view the town in its entirety.
That would be cool. Yeah, like if you had some sort of overhead view.
Yeah, like a little location where you could actually just like have a look through something.
Right, because sometimes you do kind of lose what you're looking for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would just, it's not so much for navigation, but just to see, you know, what you've created to an extent, you know, the your influence on the town, like what it looks like from it. Because, you know, that is so much of the game, is your effect on the environment and over a long period of time and kind of watching how the changes. It just seems like something obvious to me, but that isn't in there. But yeah, I'm sure
maybe
they have their reasons.
Mm-hmm. Well, this discussion, like the real Animal Crossing, is putting me to sleep. So I'm going to ask James to take over here.
All right.
What do you got, man?
So I still haven't finished
Ace Combat
Core 4 Answer.
Ace Combat. Oh, yeah.
But, you will never finish that game.
I might have mistakenly said that the level I was playing, level 7, was the last level. That's not true. There's actually two sets of 7 levels. I did manage to get through that clusterfuck and then breezed right through the next 6 levels, which you would think, if you're following a scale of difficulty, it would be harder. But I, in fact, beat the next 6 levels in 30 minutes total and then got dropped into another ridiculously difficult level. So, moving on, I just I went and I bought two. I got a really, really good deal on 2 games, Soul Calibur 4 and Dead Rising.
Dead Rising Chop Till You Drop?
No. God, no.
Heaven forbid.
The game, not the travesty. Mm. So actually, I don't know, which one do you think I have a better chance of someone here having played?
Well, I've played Soul Calibur 4. I actually have Dead Rising, but I've never played it. I just got it cheap.
Well, I guess
just
we're
playing in the backlog.
I played the demo.
I guess we'll work on Soul Calibur 4 then. I don't know. John, did you feel like it was like they almost tried to make the Star Wars characters in there ridiculously powerful?
The apprentice is retarded.
Yes.
Because, I mean, I didn't have a problem. That's the thing. Actually, I don't know if I've actually played with Yoda too much. I know I have him, but I haven't really played. I played quite a bit with Darth Vader. But I just thought, like, it's like every single other character, you can open them pretty easily. And then you just try to beat the apprentice, and the apprentice just absolutely destroys
exactly.
you.
Exactly. That's where I was going with it.
And it
apprentice.
Sucks, and that's actually where I kind of stopped playing it. I was just like,
I have run my 3 best characters into that buzzsaw.
Yeah.
And I actually got him within one hit of beating him after my 30-second attempt. 32 sets of 2 or 3 fights, and I got within one hit of beating him. And then he went on this ridiculous chain of just complete annihilation that wiped me out.
Yeah, well, when I first played him, I actually played him like 2 or 3 times, and I did pretty well. And the one time I actually came close to beating him, very close, and he beat me with some move right at the very end of the match.
Yeah.
But then after that, it's kind of like reality kicked in, and he kicked my ass consistently after that.
Yes. And I think it's making me miss getting my ass beat by Armored Core.
Yeah.
Because at least I felt like that was my fault.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like I was getting closer to beating Spirit of Mother Will.
Mm-hmm.
I don't feel like I'm getting any closer to beating this guy. I feel like some matches, I can kind of control the flow a little bit. But if he has this gear that kicks in, and once it kicks in, you are fucked.
Yeah,
you're fucked, sir.
Yes, I agree.
Because all right, I'm from this perspective. You fight him in the tower, not the tower. What's it called? Arcade mode.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think he's like number 9.
Mm-hmm.
I went perfect the entire arcade mode up to him one time.
Yeah.
Perfect rounds, every single round. Didn't get hit the entire game to him. I got wiped out in 2 rounds.
Yeah.
It's absurd.
You. Yep.
And I'm wondering if maybe this was done to make the characters look better as part of the licensing agreement with LucasArts. is that a little too, not inside baseball, but a little too...
Very cynical.
But oh yeah, why The Apprentice, though? I mean, why not Vader?
He doesn't even have a name.
Yeah, no,
it's The Apprentice.
I think it irritates me that they even, like, that character, The Apprentice. I mean, come on. I mean, that's a blatant, like, tie-in to their...
Yeah, well, it was, because the games basically came out around the same time, didn't they?
Yeah.
Yeah, they did.
Yeah, and Yoda's not that hard. I mean, he's kind of a little bastard because he's so hard to hit.
He's just tracking him down more than anything.
Yeah. He's kind of powerful, Yoda, from what I played with him.
Mm-hmm.
But... The Apprentice, Jesus.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't unlock him, can you?
I think you can.
You can, yeah. That, really?
You can
beat
him
and unlock him.
You can.
Yeah, you can.
But wasn't this a complaint about Link in Soul Calibur 2 on GameCube?
No, not even close. Not even close.
So it wasn't that Link was super powerful. Was it just that he was really cheap?
Yeah, he was pretty cheap. But this guy is absurdly cheap.
Yeah.
He has a 3-hit combo that once it starts, you can't do anything about it.
Yeah.
Half-Life's gone. And then he can immediately begin the combo again before you get back up.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't tend to, but he has done it before.
So, James, have you played any games that you enjoyed? I'm just going to keep asking it every week.
He's going to be like Shawshank Redemption, where Andy writes a letter every week asking for funds.
Yeah.
Except he gets a response in about 14 years.
Yeah. Well, you know, I actually... It's not that I didn't enjoy the game. I mean, you know, I didn't play Soul Calibur 3 because of the money hats. So I didn't have access to it. For those not aware, it was a PS2 exclusive simply because Sony threw a boatload of cash at Namco and said, please don't put this on any other system. Here's $20 million.
How Microsoft of them?
Yeah, well...
Yeah, I think Namco was kind of stupid to take that deal.
Well, I think it was a good deal because I don't think they would have sold... I mean, Soul Calibur 2 sold best on the GameCube by a wide margin, but that's because Link was in it.
Yep.
I mean, let's not kid ourselves. Link was on the cover, and that
could have put Mario in Soul Calibur 3.
Oh, yes. That would have been wonderful.
How appropriate.
EA did it. EA put it in their damn NBA game.
He fights from mushrooms. Fire flames from his hand. He gleans justice.
He could use the cape as his weapon.
What would the intro have been? Because, I mean, the intro for Yoda is ridiculous.
He stands tall in the face of darkness. A warrior. Alone.
It's like, what?
I know, it's Yoda. It's like...
But, I mean, the most bizarre thing about this game is there's some of the characters kind of have dialogue between them.
Yeah.
In the opening sequence, it's like, it kind of works, so maybe it was intentional.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe they just record, like, hey, these two kind of work together. And everyone that Yoda has, it's like, he makes fun of the people. I'm like, this is bizarre.
Destroy you, I must.
That's my best Yoda.
So, I played Mirror's Edge last week. You know, I talked about it last show, and I had just barely started it. I ended up getting really sick over the weekend, and so I stayed in, and I had plenty of time to play it. So I ended up finishing it a few days later. And, I mean, my final impression of the game is more positive than it was when I talked about it last week. Because I, you know, through the course of playing through it, I got to see some really cool places. I did some cool things. And you know, the environments, the way the game is put together is great. Conceptually, it's great from start to finish. And the last level is brilliant. I have no issues with that at all. But the execution really doesn't get better as you go through. You get more used to dealing with the crazy quirks of the controls and the hit detection and everything. And so, to some extent, I ended up failing less, perhaps, on the things I was failing at to begin with. But then as the game gets more difficult and they throw more complex platforming at you, you end up failing just as much. It's just that you're failing on more difficult things. So the level of frustration never really goes down. I mean, it's pretty high consistently all the way through the game. There were sections of the game that I played through. I had to restart easily 30 times before I finally got through it. And I mean, I was just cursing under my breath, very close to throwing controllers across the room, which I don't do. And there were a few times where I just had to stand up and like walk to the other room and take a break because I was so pissed at the game.
But how much did the game actually punish you for failure?
Not very much at all. I mean, it just restarts you 20 seconds before.
So it's not like, say...
No, it's not punishing in that way. It's just that you end up playing the same 10 seconds over and over and over. And again, once you finally actually get past it, a lot of times you don't really know what you did differently. It just seems very arbitrary whether you pass a certain obstacle or not. But I'm glad I played through it, but I wouldn't play through it again. That's for damn sure.
So what do you think? I mean, because I'm sure they'll do a sequel to it. So what's the number one thing you would like to see in a sequel?
I'm not sure that they will. It didn't sell very well.
I think they've already intimated they're going to.
Yeah.
I hope they do, because, again, it's a great concept. You fix some of the execution problems, and it could be a great game. I think, for one thing, the world they've created, although it's very beautiful, it's also totally ridiculous. The only people in the game that you ever see are the good guys and the bad guys. And you're running through a city.
Yeah, but you're also running through parts of the city that are like the roofs.
There are places where you're crossing a freeway, you're running through train stations, malls. I mean, you go through malls, buildings. There's not a single fucking person around. It's bizarre. I mean, this is not a minor gripe. It just doesn't make any sense within its own fiction. And I think, you know, if you added some people that you kind of had to dodge, throw in a little bit of Assassin's Creed kind of crowd control issues and things like that, to me that would make more sense, and it would be cool. It would be a good addition. So that's one thing, but I mean, the main thing is they've got to fix the controls. They've got to make the controls more forgiving because there's no need for it to be as frustrating as it is. So, yeah, other than that, bring it on. Anyway, a few days ago, I got a package from Amazon with Retro Game Challenge and Personal Trainer Cooking. And I bought Personal Trainer Cooking just because I want to practice and learn a few new dishes. So I did actually take it to the grocery store with me.
But that didn't look awful at all.
Well, it's designed to do that. So, like, as you go through recipes, you put a check mark by ingredients that you don't currently have. And then as you back out to the main menu, you can go to, like, grocery list, and it'll show you a list of everything you've checked off. And
you check off games you... The things you don't
have?
No,
you check off ingredients that you don't have to make the recipes that you need.
Backwards, isn't it?
No, James. You're checking off the... You put a check mark by the ingredients that you lack.
Okay, hold on a second. So you're going to the store, and you're getting ingredients.
So yeah, I went to the grocery store, and I put my DS in the shopping cart in front of me, and I checked off... I unchecked the ingredients as I picked them off the shelves. And I felt completely ridiculous, but at the same time... it was ridiculous, of course. But at the same time, I wondered, like, would anybody stop and stare at me, or would anybody say anything or ask me? And honestly, nobody even noticed. And I think part of it is just the great design of the DS is that it doesn't look ridiculous, someone holding it, an adult holding it, you know?
Say that with the DS fat.
Yeah, that would have looked a lot sillier. But my black DS Lite, it looks pretty nice, and I think it didn't stick out that badly. But, yeah, I felt silly, but, you know, whatever. I bought some ingredients. I haven't used them yet. So the only thing I've made was one dish. The one dish I could find that I pretty much already had all the ingredients for, which was Welsh rarebit. Have you ever had this? Any?
No.
No.
It's basically cheese toast. and it turned out to be very delicious, but I don't think it was authentic because I had to substitute three or four things. Like, instead of Worcestershire sauce, I used soy sauce. Yeah, so, and instead of cheddar cheese, I had to use Jarlsberg. So it ended up being kind of an odd, rare bit, but it was tasty. Anyway, I think personal trainer cooking is a really well done product, and the voice commands do absolutely blow, though. You have to turn them off. If you're just opening cabinets, pulling out pots and pans, you know, opening jars of whatever to pour in, it apparently thinks you're saying continue as you make these noises around the kitchen. So you pretty much have to turn off voice recognition right away because it just doesn't work. But other than that, it seems like a great product. I think I'm going to get a lot of use out of it. Retro Game Challenge is pretty freaking awesome.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's this collection of pseudo 8-bit games. It's almost like a virtual console compilation, except the games never really existed. They're almost parodies of old games. You know, it's very, very easy to see what was the inspiration for these. Like, the first game you play is basically Galaga. And the nature of Galaga is such that it's so simple, it's kind of actually kind of hard to parodize. But the games that are in Retro Game Challenge, none of them are totally silly on the surface. But there are a lot of little touches here and there, especially in the more advanced ones, that have more text, you know, more art, that are pretty funny. I mean, it's very clear that they're kind of poking fun at some of your memories, but at the same time, the games are very well designed themselves. They're not joke games. They're real games, basically, that were developed for this package. And they're really good. I mean, there are a couple that I've had to go through that were definitely not my favorites. I didn't love them, but at the same time, it wasn't that bad to play through them. Basically, what happens is the game master, Areno, he gives you challenges in each one of these games. And they're almost like Xbox achievements. You know, it's like, get to the end of level 2 without dying. Or defeat 2 enemies at one time. Or, you know, reach a certain score. And the challenges are pretty easy to beat. But my problem is that there are 4 challenges per game, and you have to beat all 4 before you can go on to the next game. So if you get to a game that you don't really care for very much, you still have to play it a fair bit. I mean, you pretty much have to play it an equal amount as you did all the other ones in order to move on. You never have a choice of, well, do you want to move on to this game next or this game next? Or, okay, you beat 3 out of the 4 challenges, you can move on to the next game, or you can stick with this one and complete it. You know, finish the last challenge. It doesn't do that. It's very linear. You play one game at a time. You beat that one, now you move on to the next. And it opens them up in free play once you finish all the challenges. So you can always go back and play any of them as much as you want. And that's a great feature because some of these games, there's actually a lot more to them than the challenges will lead you to. So like, say, Super Robot Haggleman, which is the second game. The final challenge, I know.
That's a great
name. It's actually kind of a mix of Super Mario Brothers and Mappy Land. Mm-hmm. It has more to do with Mappy Land, except that it's not completely broken and shitty. I don't know if any of you have ever played Mappy Land. It's a very old Namco game.
Yeah, it's correct.
It's still not super, super fun, but it's better, you know. Anyway, the final challenge of that game may only have you getting to the end of level 3 and beating the boss, but there may be 8 levels in the game. So when you go in free play, which I'm sure I'll be doing after I finish all the challenges, you can actually play a lot more of these games than you've previously seen. And just today I got to the 6th game out of 8 total, which is Guadia Quest, which is the RPG, and I'm really excited to be playing that. It feels exactly like Dragon Quest, the first one. I mean, the whole package is great. The writing is really funny. There's some very childish stuff in the writing that I'm not a fan of, but for the most part, it's actually really good and really clever. And it really is nostalgic, and it's strange feeling nostalgic for games that are brand new. Yeah. But it does a good job of evoking that feeling.
Yeah.
And I'm starting to get really excited for the sequel, which is out in Japan now, I think, or it's about to come out.
Yeah, I saw a video on the Japanese Nintendo channel for this.
Oh, really? Tell me about it, please, because
I'm
very hungry.
I think it looks like some of the games in this one will actually be like literal sequels to games in retro channels, like some like another Guardia Quest.
Yeah.
So, but I think there's completely new games as well. So it'll kind of build on what you've had before. And it'll be very much the same sort of thing, I would have thought. But I mean, with this, there's so much you can do, really. There's so many other games you can reference, and I guess it's the really intricate stuff, doesn't it? Like, I think Guardia Quest is actually a sort of fairly unique reference. Like, there's actually a duck in a graveyard, which is a reference to the whole Castlevania 2 terrible translation about the graveyard duck. And I mean, that, like you said, it's primarily
duck in the graveyard. I didn't even get that.
No, that's exactly great.
I saw that today. Yeah, and a lot of the in-game translations are intentionally bad. Like in Guardia Quest, when you go to the inn and you want to stay at the inn and regenerate your health, the guy says, "Don't you feel asleep?" Which is a reference to Metal Gear. So there's a lot of really, really cool references like that. It's just, you know, it's great. It's very well done.
Yeah, I mean, they seem to think there's some chance, maybe dependent on sales, that the second one could also be localized. But apparently doesn't look like it's going to get published in Europe at all. I mean, I would have imported it from America anyway, probably. But
well, that's what
you should. You should, Greg. You'll love.
But for others, and importing is getting more costly these days. But for others, that will probably be a bit of a disappointment. It's a shame that that's not coming. But
it is. Yeah. I mean, I think to some extent, culturally, it probably doesn't make as much sense in Europe, because during the 8-bit, there was this huge divergence of what America was playing and what Europe was playing, and then it started to come together a few years later.
Well, and there's also quite great variants just across Europe. If you're releasing it across a region, you know, maybe it would work somewhat in the UK, but it really wouldn't in other places. Or, you know, that's also an issue.
And certainly I think Europeans of every nationality would probably enjoy this game if they are familiar with games of that era, even if they didn't actually play some of the games that inspired these. But I can understand from a publisher's point of view being kind of wary of that kind of release, because it's sort of like doing Captain Rainbow in America. Like, we're not going to there might be some people here who want to play it, but really we're not going to understand it. And I think Retro Game Challenge is so nostalgia based that it may just not come across very well, but that would be too bad.
Now, that it was done by Xseed, right? Isn't that who?
Yeah, they published it in America.
Yeah,
it's Namco.
It's developed by Namco Bandai.
Okay,
and they published it in Japan.
Yeah, Xseed's just sort of publishing a lot of games that probably wouldn't have made it over here without their intervention.
Mm-hmm.
Did they translate it? Do you know?
Yeah, they translated it.
That's pretty cool. It sounds like they did a good job with it.
I think for the most part, they did a great job. I mean, like I said, there's some stupid stuff, like when some of the writing in the game magazine is a little childish. Like when they have the letters section,
boobies.
The names of the people are basically boobies.
Yes.
Well, I will say, though, Johnny, there were game magazines in Britain in the early 90s that were pretty much like that.
Was gaming journalism in the 90s. What are you talking about?
Yeah, so, I mean, I don't know, maybe you had higher standards in North America.
No, we didn't.
I guess so. Well, the other weird thing about the magazines is that I think they got permission from a lot of video game writers and editors to use their likenesses in the game, because you've got Dan Shu is in the game. I mean, there are photos of Dan Shu in the game, but his name is Dan Sock. There's James Milkey, who's called Milkman. There's John Davison, who's called Johnny England. And I don't even know who all else is going to show up. But that's cool. I just kept thinking, man, I wish they had asked me. Not that they would, but I'm not famous enough. But it would be awesome.
call him Johnny the sexiest. Call him sexiest man.
To sexies. No, that's a terrible joke.
I wish they'd asked me so I could say no.
But I've talked about it too long already. John, please finish us up.
There's a couple games. There's a bunch of actually big games, big releases coming out this month. Last night I picked up Street Fighter 4.
It's out, isn't it?
Yeah, it just came out. I picked it up for PS3. I got the collector's version of it, of course, which was interesting because apparently there was quite a shortage. There's actually quite a shortage around the game right now as it stands. I guess a lot of the online retailers haven't received their shipments from Capcom. So there's a whole bunch of people, like Amazon, I think, just started shipping it out today, and there's a whole bunch of people that have kind of been left out in the cold with online pre-orders because they're all
sitting
there.
Did you buy a stick with it?
Yeah, actually, I'm getting that the ridiculous tournament stick with it, the one with all the
like $170.
Oh yeah, you bet. Well, they had a good deal on Capcom. It was like, I mean, a good deal being $130, but for that stick, it's basically like straight out of the arcade, all Sanwa parts. So I mean, you're pretty much not going to get a better stick for it. I mean, it's really good so far. I'm not like some sort of Street Fighter master. I've barely even played the game. I didn't even play it back in the arcades. But
John doesn't know what Street Fighter is.
Oh, I know all about Street Fighter.
Heard of it.
But that's the thing. But I mean, probably the last Street Fighter game I played really was, you know, back in the arcades, or Street Fighter 2 Turbo.
I mean, I haven't played a Street Fighter game since one of the iterations of 2.
Yeah, I mean, like all of like, you know, the stuff like, you know, Third Strike and all that, whatever. Dual Impact.
Yeah, but I mean, I understand why you got the PS3 version, because you didn't want to have to fight me. I understand that. I respect your need to not be beaten savagely, but I will continue to refer to you as a coward.
Well, you know, I guess we'll never be able. The world will never see that showdown take place. So, you know, I feel kind of bad, I guess.
That massacre.
But anyways, yeah, the game is actually, it's pretty cool. I mean, it's Street Fighter. I mean, you know, you're going to get exactly what you want, and, you know, there's tons of stuff to unlock. There's all kinds of medals. There's all kinds of, you know, picture galleries, movies, all kinds of stuff to unlock. So, I mean, what I'm doing, since I really don't even know how to play it, is I'm glad
you press buttons.
Well, that's the thing. It was interesting, actually. There was an interesting blog on the MTV multiplayer blog. Steven Totilo, he wrote a good article about his headline was, "I am not going to review Street Fighter 4." And his entire point was that he was just really not good enough at the game to even bother reviewing it, because he wouldn't even get as much out of it as somebody who actually knew how to play Street Fighter would. What he was talking about, the one really good hint that I'm glad he gave, was that there's a mode in there called Challenge Mode. And within that Challenge Mode, there's a Trial Mode. And what that actually is, and I don't know why they didn't just call this training, is it has you go through and do every single move. And that's like it'll line up 5 moves, and what you have to do is execute those 5 moves, and they go in, as it gets harder, they go into combos and stuff like that. And it actually teaches you how to play, but it's buried somewhere within this menu structure, and I don't know why they just didn't call it training, because it really helps.
Because they don't want you to train, they want you to learn it in the heat of battle.
Yeah.
I think we should use Totillo's argument the next time we get a Mystery Dungeon game.
No, I think we should hire somebody new off the street next time we get a Mystery Dungeon game.
I know we're gonna hire somebody just to review, you know.
I do believe we need to send the next Mystery Dungeon game to John.
The thing is, now I can veto it. Forget it, man. No way. Now I can veto it.
So you actually took on the poison chalice of directing the site expressly to prevent that actor, unfortunately. So.
I've been exposed. That's exactly why I did it. Because I knew I was next.
John,
I was next in line.
What was the other thing you bought, man?
I also bought... I picked up Grand Theft Auto Lost and Damned. Have not played it.
Yeah, I saw you were downloading it earlier.
Yeah, it's big. It's like 1.78 gigs.
Well, it's a full game, isn't it?
It's actually... You choose it from the main menu. It's like its own little sub game. I'm not too sure.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's like a full story, isn't it?
Yeah, it's like
I've heard it's about 20 hours, so it's about one third the size of
GTA 4.
That's
huge.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah, it's.
I mean, I know it piggybacks a lot of assets off GTA 4. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
Still, well, it's got
to
be huge.
I'm gonna be very interested to hear what you think of it, John, because I've pretty much decided I don't want it.
Yeah.
And not because I think it's bad, but because it doesn't make sense for me to buy more GTA 4 when I'm having to force myself to finish the stuff I already bought.
Mm-hmm.
You know, GTA 4 is a game that, like, I feel like I should keep playing it. I feel like part of me wants to, but, like, when I'm actually playing it, it's so annoying and slow that...
Yeah.
I'm not enjoying myself. It feels like work to play through it.
I'm with you, man.
And it's work that I'm making myself do, and I don't know why I keep going back to it.
Yeah,
but
I'm with you.
I think part of it is it's so stingy on achievement points. I feel like if I play one more hour, they'll all be revealed to me, and it's not going to happen either. But it just doesn't make. I can't justify it to myself to buy the download, even though it's interesting.
Well, the one thing that I brought this up when we were talking about GTA 4 originally is the fact that I hated that they didn't have mid-mission checkpoints. So if you died at the very, very end, you would have to start out at the very, very beginning. And in Lost and Damned, they finally have actually added in checkpoints at the middle of a mission. So,
oh, it only took them four games with multiple iterations of each to get it.
Yep.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's right up there with, like, putting the retry button in Burnout Paradise.
You know? Seriously. So, that's a really good development. Yeah. That's a really good...
So, and the other thing, so yeah, so I'll play that this week and see how I like it. The other thing is I played the Killzone 2, I got a code to get download the Killzone 2 demo. And that's actually really good. Really, really good. It's gritty and violent. The graphics are really amazing. That's really good. I'm really looking forward to that.
So the director of Nintendo World Report is currently playing Street Fighter 4, GTA 4, and Killzone 2.
Well, hey, if all these came out on the Wii, I'd be playing them. Beginning. So.
Yeah, I know. Oh, man. Okay, we're going to wrap up new business and pretty briefly finish up Luigi's Mansion for Retroactive. I think we covered most of it last week, but I played a little bit more after we recorded last week and got to the end of the game. I just kind of wanted to see if you guys had any thoughts about the later sections of the game, maybe if you thought they were kind of different than the beginning, and then the final boss.
Yeah, well, I finished it off in the interim between this episode and the last, and yeah, I mean, it's obviously not that different. Okay, well, we touched on that last week. The game is not terribly different through its entirety. You get a few little events. Like, I don't think we discussed the whole part where, like, after you beat that Boulossus boss, like, you have the blackout where it's just ghosts everywhere for a while and stuff. Yeah. Like, they put in these, like, little events to, like, kind of break things
up
a bit.
What I'm curious about here is when you say these little breaks. What do you mean?
Well, look, throughout the entire game, you go into a room you haven't been in before, and it's dark.
Right.
And some ghosts are in there, and you catch ghosts until it goes light, and then it stays light. And you do this for many, many, many rooms.
Ad nauseam.
Until a part in the game where everything goes dark, which means there's always ghosts everywhere for a while.
Right.
No matter how many
nowhere
of them
is safe.
Yeah, no matter how many of them you catch until you switch the lights back on. So that's what I mean by it breaks the monotony
of that.
Are you
going to
dispute that that's a change in the pattern?
Well, I think it breaks the flow. I'm not sure it relieves the monotony.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to... See, I didn't really consider it breaking things up. I just considered it them being dicks.
It doesn't necessarily improve it.
No, it means breaking it apart in this case. You know, it's separating out the portions of the same thing over and over again a little. And, you know, that's where they're trying to make it feel a bit more dynamic, but it doesn't really achieve that very well.
No.
It's pretty fleeting, and then, you know, and again, all you'll end up doing is pretty much just, like, running through a few rooms. I guess all it does is it makes it a bit less kind of like when you're backtracking, crisscrossing through the mansion, normally when the lights are on and everything, it's just... I mean, you are literally just walking quite slowly.
Yeah.
I suppose in that sense, it's kind of...
shuffling, I would say.
yeah, that's probably about right. You know, whereas, you know, for that period, you know, you are at least having to sort of deal with, like, threats while you're walking through the same corridors again and again.
Well, I felt like the later sections of the game were kind of disappointing because... Well, I mean, the puzzle ghosts, like the portrait ghosts, were actually... got better and better, I felt. Like, they're always fresh, always interesting. But everything else, and especially the booze, they didn't get more difficult, they just got more tedious. It's like they just...
Yeah, the health.
Okay, now this one has triple the hit points, and it's going to pass back and forth through the walls over and over and over, and you have to follow it for 10 minutes before you finally kill it. And it's just like, it's really trying your patience, you know?
It's kind of farcical sometimes, you know, in terms of there's no way of preventing it from sort of hopping from one room to another. And so you'll literally just keep following it from one room to another, and of course it takes a certain amount of time to just open the door and go from one to the other. So it's this absurdly slow piecemeal sort of thing where you're just standing next to it and slowly eroding itself. It's just bad. I mean, it just
it would be really amusing if it all happened at triple speed and you were listening to Yakety Sax play over the background. But in real time, it's actually not amusing at all. It's just annoying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do we know how many boos you actually have to do to get to the last boss? Because I didn't have them all when I went there.
Almost all of them.
I think I was three short, but I'm not sure.
I'm not sure what the exact number is.
Yeah, there are very few optional boos. Because you have to get all of the ones on the basement in order to get to the last boss. So, and there's several down there. And then, of course, you end up getting about 20 from the boss, Bulossus.
Yeah.
And then there are several, you have to get 5 or 10 right when they first appear before you can get a key to move on. So you end up, you're pretty much forced to get most of them.
Definitely, yeah, it must be most, but I was wondering if we knew what the threshold was. But regardless, it's pretty high, and that will involve some tedious acquisition of them.
Right. And the most annoying ones are in the basement, those are the ones that are required, and those are the ones with 300 hit points who fly back and forth in and out of the hallway constantly. I just that's the point where I was like, give me a break. I just want this to be over.
Well, again, it feels kind of like the boos may have been something that was layered on top of the game design that they had at one point to pad it further.
Mm-hmm. I can see that.
There's nothing much to it. It's just like, so when you've cleared a room, your little radar thing starts clicking and you poke around for a little bit and a boo comes out, and then you pretty much just hold the vacuum button down while standing close to it, and that's it.
It's a chore.
And like you said, with the bit early in the game, they introduced the boos to catch the 5 of them as another way of sort of breaking up the action again.
Right.
So that's kind of what they did with it, is just breaking up and stretching out what they already had. I really think that. I doubt that was in the game from the start. I really do.
Well, I was very surprised when I finally got to the final boss, Bowser. Really King Boo, but you're sort of fighting Bowser, and I couldn't believe how difficult it is. It's incredibly difficult relative to the rest of the game.
Okay, relative to the rest of the game
is something quite a step change. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, from just a straight standpoint, I wouldn't say it's especially difficult, but I would say compared to the rest of the game, yeah.
I find that it's difficult for a few reasons. First, Luigi moves so slowly, it's difficult to avoid some of the attacks. Second, the camera doesn't pan around properly, so sometimes you can't actually see where the boss is or where his attacks are coming from.
And third, it's out one place, really.
Right, and third, the only way to regain any kind of health during the battle is basically left up to luck, because you can't really control when he breaks the pillars, and the pillars probably won't have hearts in them.
Yeah,
they might, if you're very lucky.
And they may trigger the poison mushroom, yeah.
Right, which would be even worse. So yeah, I still haven't beaten the boss, and I don't think I'm going to, because I played it 2 or 3 times, I got very annoyed at some of these things, and...
Well, don't forget, there's the stupid thing that you have to walk back there and sit through the cutscene.
Right, exactly.
That's ridiculous. How could you not have a retry function?
Just not interested in doing it anymore. I don't think... the Hidden Mansion, or what? You guys will have to tell me about this, because I don't think I've ever really played the Hidden Mansion.
I replayed through it through the Hidden Mansion at the time. I haven't since I beat the last boss on this playthrough, and it really, as I recall, it is trivially different.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not worth mentioning.
No, it's really not.
That's a shame. Mm-hmm. And so I don't have any motivation to beat the game.
Oh, well, in that case, it's amazing, and you should go do it
regarding the last boss, I do like it quite a lot. Because it is actually threatening. I think that's hilarious.
It might be the most ghastly thing in the game.
Oh, definitely.
In what way are you...
Well, because he takes his fucking head off.
Yeah, like he's not cutesy.
Yeah,
and he puts it on, the best bit's when he puts it on backwards and
just
goes
mental.
Yeah, and
then he has to, like, fix it. I mean, it's pretty... It's kind of grotesque.
Yeah,
I don't know.
It's definitely it's definitely a little more just fun and kind of than a lot of it. And the thing is, I think one of the reasons why it's so difficult is actually is just how much damage he can do if you get caught in the attack.
If he sucks you in, you're down for 30, 40
You are almost guaranteed to get hit with the fire after that.
Exactly.
And the way they calibrated it in terms of how much damage those attacks do means that basically you had better never be in range of his mouth unless you've got one of those mines on the end of your vacuum to blow his head off with.
Which are very hard to aim.
That's not helpful, because again, like you said, with the camera, it doesn't really, sometimes it's a bit unclear to see like how you're aligned.
You really need to get into basically point blank range.
If you are too point blank, the mine will blow you up as well.
Yeah,
so you will actually lose health. But
not only that, but I had a number of times when I shot the mine at him and it hit Bowser and didn't do anything.
Yeah, so the way I tend to do is like, it seemed to be most of it when he was literally going to attack, like he thrust his head forward.
Right. I think there's a very short window when he's actually vulnerable.
And so the only time you should ever be anywhere near him is when you've got a mine ready to deploy on his face, and then the head will come off, and then you can sort of suck Boo, which is back to our favourite Boo catching mechanic again. But at least in this case, actually, there's something...
So there's something shooting at you.
Because Bowser's sort of detached head is shooting at you at the same time, so you have to concentrate on two things at once.
Like, right.
You have to sort of try and move.
It's much
with...
more anxious Boo fight.
Yeah, well, that's the thing that really annoys me, because there's some of this sort of going on in the rest of the game, because, like, sometimes, like you mentioned last week, with like, those enemies that throw bananas on the floor, or, there's other things, like the poison mushrooms that come out that can shrink you. They might be sort of floating around on the floor. But a lot of the time when you're catching normal ghosts rather than Boos, you don't really control where you're going on the floor. So there's no skill to avoiding those things
you're
while...
you're basically being kind of dragged around.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so there's no skill to avoiding those things while catching the ghosts. It's just a lottery, and that's bad. I mean, it's just...
It's
poor.
Really funny to watch, but it gets old. It gets really old after a while.
With the Boos, it kind of makes some sense, because you have freedom of movement when you're catching a Boo, but then they don't really utilize that until the last boss fight.
Right. Well, anyway,
One thing I want to make a quick statement about my previous statement from last week about how amazing the effects are in this game still.
Mm-hmm.
The fire effects in the boss battle, not the case.
You want about the background? Mm-hmm.
Yes. It looks just like some N64 backgrounds, but you know
the background is not so. I mean, it's kind of funny, is they've got some sort of hell dimension to have
But what's interesting is the character model, especially Bowser's, is really bland. It has no textures on it whatsoever.
That's right. It's very kind of Garou-shaded.
It's very plasticky,
almost.
Although that does kind of make some sort of sense in the context of the battle.
Yeah, I guess
it could
it
be
does,
intentional.
But I don't think that was their intention.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
When you compare it to the Bowser model in Melee, which came out a couple months later.
Yeah, it's night and day.
Yeah.
Right. All right, well, we need to move on to the forum post. These are just a few more little comments I picked out of the thread, and then we'll be closing the book on Luigi's Mansion. So, Greg, can you read this first one, please?
Yeah, so this is from Stratos, and he posted, on the third floor, I was juggling like 5 300-plus hit point Boos between the rooms. It got very tedious, though the basement ones were worse because of how the dust reset itself, and you had to vacuum it up each time to get by. Obviously we did talk about this, and that's true. There is one room where it's like, you get to use the vacuum to actually do vacuuming. but it regenerates.
It's really annoying.
It regenerates every time, and you have to quite thoroughly vacuum up all these piles of dust just to get through the room.
Yeah.
Bizarre.
Well, that's why they put those flip spots on there. It's kind of a shortcut, but that doesn't help you when you're fighting the Boo. That Boo is probably the most annoying Boo in the entire game, just because you can't really walk around where you want to. All right, James, can you read the next one, please?
All right, so Golden Phoenix posted, you sing right. Is it just me, or does Luigi's Mansion have one of the most morbid, disturbing boss battles of any Mario game? Especially considering the context of the prophecies. It still creeps me out, and I remember at the time it made me fear who was the main villain wasn't in Super Mario Sunshine. Now, we kind of talked about this. She's referencing the fact that in the game, you fight Bowser kind of, but really it's King Boo's inside him, and you blow Bowser's head off. And then the head floats around and shoots ice crystals at you while King Boo's getting mauled by your vacuum, and the body's kind of just standing there.
Yeah, so it's like, I guess it's like a Bowser suit, like some sort of costume, probably, rather than his actual corpse.
Yeah.
But it
never says that.
It doesn't look like a corpse.
but then what would a corpse look like in Mario?
Very cute.
It looked like Dry Bowser.
Yeah. But what I think Golden Phoenix is talking about, there's a part in the game, you know, the fortune teller ghost?
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a bit where she says she sees Bowser, but then she says, but I thought he was dead.
Yeah.
So it's kind of, that's almost like leading to think, so what, if Bowser is dead, then is this his body?
I guess they implied that he died in Mario 64, I mean.
Well, he's died a lot, you know.
Yeah. I don't know. To me, the final boss battle is not morbid at all. The morbid boss battle, the really disturbing boss battle in Luigi's Mansion, is when you're sucking up a baby ghost. I mean, first of all, the idea of a ghost baby creeps me out, okay? It's just not right. But then the idea that the ghost baby is a boss, and the ghost baby's trying to kill you, and you're exacting your retribution by putting it away forever.
Self-defense.
I know, but there's just, that's wrong. That I have issues with. That is the most disturbing.
I'm being attacked by a demonic baby, a baby's going down.
And he shrunk you so you're tiny in his crib.
Yeah,
his,
I mean,
but like, enormous.
That's the kind of thing that would fit into a horror movie. You know, a ghost baby, train spotting, something like that. But,
well,
I don't know,
horror movie.
A Bowser costume with head flying off, that doesn't bother me very much. Trainspotting, it can be a horror movie. That part of it is very horrifying.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, and the last forum post we have here is from Nova Q. I remember the last boss taking me a long time to figure out when I played the game. If he runs into the pillars, it destroys them and yields hearts. Even still, though, you have to find a good rhythm and range for your attacks and defense to take him down. And that's, you know, we pretty much already said that. But yeah, to me, the process and everything was just not entertaining.
The one thing I would say about in terms of the figuring out part, the reason why it takes quite a while is because there's not any obvious visual indication in a brief period that you can suck up the mines. Because
you have to walk into them.
Yeah, most of the things in the game very obviously respond to the vacuum,
right,
as we kind of talked about
flying
last week.
To it at Mach 2.
And in this, you can be standing pretty close to it, and it doesn't even kind of like shudder or anything.
No,
it's like Johnny's, you have to be right next to it, and then holding for a sustained period, and then it will stick. There's not many different possibilities to run down here. He throws, he does a bunch of different attacks.
And if you've played,
you intuitively know it's got to be something that he does that you kind of turn against him. And obviously those big spiky mines are a really obvious thing, but it's just that you could quite easily just think, oh, I've tried to suck them up, but I can't. So it's not that.
Right. But if you don't hit him with a mine, that's really the only thing he's attacking you with, isn't it? Because the ice things come out after you knock his head off.
He's got fire attacks.
But,
he's got sucking up attack.
You do suck fire up in a.
Yeah, except not against Bowser. Yeah. The whole fight is very inconsistent with the rest of the game. Like the rules that you've learned no longer apply against Bowser.
Well, it's a fucking suit walking onto a ghost in his head. Rules are out the window, man.
Yeah. That's the end of Luigi's Mansion. Thanks to everybody who played along, left comments, voted in the poll. And actually, our next poll just ended, and the next game we play for Retroactive is going to be Eternal Darkness Sanity's Requiem. Another GameCube game. We're not going to make it a habit.
Death-themed game.
Yeah, another dark game. Well, Dynamite Heady was pretty bright. This game actually might give Dynamite Heady a run for its money in the Insanity category. I'm pretty excited to go back and play this. I played Eternal Darkness 3 times straight through when it first came out, and I haven't touched it since.
Oh, I guess I probably shouldn't say why you did that.
Well, anyway, you only need to play through it once for Retroactive. And actually, we're going to take a little break next week, and we will not be talking about it next week. Just to give everybody a little breather, give you time to go track it down, play through it a little more maybe. And then the week after that, we'll be starting our discussion of Eternal Darkness for GameCube. So go find your copy. And I've also set up a dedicated thread in the forums for making suggestions for future games. So if you have a game that you think would be appropriate for this feature, and most things would apply, throw it in there, maybe explain why you think it's a good choice, and then the next time we do a poll, I will go through there and dig out some nominations, and your game might be one of them.
Just make sure it's Super Ghouls and Ghosts. FYI.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think we should just get it out of the way, just because just take the bitter
John,
pill.
It's a democratic process.
I'm just saying, man. It's going to happen. It's going to happen.
All right. So now we're going to take a break. We'll be back with listener mail and a bit of news. See you around the bend. I don't know. right, we are back with your listener mail. We're getting a little low in the pile, actually, so we welcome your letters, as always, to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. And you can be read on the air, just like
Austin,
which will be read by Greg.
This is from Austin. He writes, "Dear RFN, I love the Zelda games, but there's one thing about them that annoys me. Why don't they include a save system that lets you save your position anywhere? If you're in the middle of a dungeon and an issue arises in the real world that forces you to stop playing, you must restart that dungeon and its puzzles when you return. I think that forcing you to restart a dungeon from the beginning if you don't finish it in is an artificial source of difficulty. What are your thoughts on this?"
I know why. There's a technical reason, and then there's a gameplay reason. The technical reason is that it would require a more complicated saving system, because you have to save position and all the environmental variables of the dungeon. The gameplay decision is it would make the game really easy.
Okay, James, now let me poke a hole in both of your reasons, because in Twilight Princess you actually can save inside of a dungeon.
Well, you can save inside of some other dungeons in the past, but it doesn't save your exact position.
Yeah, you just appear at the entrance.
Right.
But you can, in Twilight Princess, you use the Uku, or whatever her name is, mm-hmm. and she creates a warp point, you warp out, then you save, then you come back later, go in, she takes you back to where you left off, and now you're deep in the dungeon with everything exactly the same way you left it. And I think you can do the same with Feroar's Wind in Ocarina of Time.
Yeah, that's what Feroar's Wind does.
But what does I actually mean, like, save, like, your spot right here, you know, or right here, or right here.
It brings you to the room, at least.
Yeah, it achieves a similar sort of thing.
But there's one thing that doesn't do. It doesn't take you right to the brink of a point where you could fuck it up. Save, fuck it up, and then reload, and immediately be able to try again.
I mean, I've always looked at it like a design choice, because I think it's trying to maintain kind of the action roots of the original games. In the sense that, you know, it takes some skill. You have to actually make a run all the way through a certain area, and instead of having it like an RPG where you can just save anywhere.
Most RPGs you can't save anywhere.
Yeah, except save like spots.
Except like American PC RPGs.
Yeah, I guess I've just been playing too many of those, as opposed to like, you know, as opposed to JRPGs with save points. That's a good point.
I mean, with this sort of issue, the sort of impact of it is dependent on the design of the dungeons. I mean, let's take two examples from Twilight Princess. One would be the Temple of Time, which is a linear design, which means that, where you literally go all the way to the end and then you come all the way back again. And if for some reason, you know, you have to restart that, that's a real pain in the arse if you haven't done the Uku thing or whatever. So I can understand the irritation there. Whereas if they're designed more like the Snow Mansion or whatever it is, which is like a hub kind of dungeon where, you know, everything kind of, you've got the central room and it's all split off from that, you're never that far from where you were. So I would say in Twilight Princess, the only time I've really thrown up a problem for me would have been in the Temple of Time, because the rest of them were kind of designed reasonably enough that it was never that much of a chore.
Yeah, it's usually not a big deal in Zelda because of the design of the dungeons, but they do give you these tools. Now, you may not use them, you may not understand how to use them, they're typically not explained very well by the games.
Yeah.
That's definitely the case in Ocarina of Time. In Twilight Princess, it's explained a little better, and that's actually the first time I ever tried using one of those things. I mean, I can understand Nintendo not wanting you to be able to basically like save a state of exactly where you are at any time you want to, because there may be situations in which, you know, you mess up a puzzle and now you're trapped and you can't get out, but it seems like they always give you tools that let you warp out one way or the other.
They would actually, I mean, you'd hope they could design the dungeon so that wouldn't happen as well, you know, I mean.
Right, of course.
Of course, with Phantom Hourglass, you could just close up your DS, so that kind of mitigates against that to some extent.
But it still doesn't give you the ability to, if you fuck it up, start right back where you effed up. Just closing the DS.
No, but, you know, what he's talking about in terms of real life kind of getting in the way is literally, I need to stop playing this now, not because I messed something up, but purely just because I can't be sitting
in front
of the table.
I understand that's why he would do it, but I think that has, in a way, at least influenced their decision to do it the way they do.
Yeah, that may well be a factor.
And I think another part is the fact that the game's dungeons are set up so compartmentalized. You know, they're rooms. And
right.
There's very clear definition. This is an area, this is an area, this is an area. they would be perfectly happy to just enable saving as you enter areas like they do with whatever her name is.
Uku.
Yeah. Yeah, I think they would be perfectly acceptable for them to let you save as you enter a room, but I think that they probably regard once you enter the room each time as being a different, I guess, appearance.
Well, they do, because all the enemies reset.
Yeah.
Usually
yeah.
The puzzle stuff resets. All the pots are now unbroken, and the grass is regrown. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I think it also plays into their puzzles also. I mean, you know, there's puzzles in each room, so they have to reset the puzzle every time. So what's right. The point of having those puzzles if you could just save in the middle of them and then just keep going back and going back and going back?
Yeah, I think some of those puzzles where you have to experiment, they would certainly lose something.
Okay, well, James, you have the next letter.
Scott writes in from Maryland, "Guys, love the podcast. Mix of cool Nintendo stuff and a little sprinkle of reality. I stopped listening to IGNN The Wire because they're boring. I could have called it The Weir, but that sounds disgusting."
No, it's the Wire.
I was... It's got two eyes, man. I was surfing your site for the first time, and I was kind of disappointed on a few points. The rumor section hasn't seen an update in 2 years. The profiles didn't contain pictures. I like to put faces to the voices. Also, James Jones' profile was thin. Sorry, James, for calling you out like that. Keep up the good work.
James doesn't care. I mean, really.
In my defense, I haven't updated the profile since I was actually given it, which was actually 2 months after I started writing for the site.
Ouch.
Yeah.
I forgot about that.
Yeah, that was...
I mean, it wasn't my fault, but no, I forgot that happened.
Yeah.
It sucks. The rumors section is something that we've been talking about lately. I don't know if we want to get into it.
Go for it.
We're thinking about it. I don't know. John, you're the authority on this.
Yeah, I mean, we're considering it. I mean, I think that people always like rumors. The thing is with rumors, though, you walk a fine line. You don't want to just throw something out there that's, you know, totally baseless. Mm.
Well, and also, you know? I mean, you know, I guess with most, but with like, you know, say like the rumor sections on things like IGN and 1UP, especially back in the day or whatever, it's kind of, I guess people assume... even though sometimes you have these little fictional characters that are kind of writing them, that you know, this is based on things that the actual, you know, journalists have heard, but they can't really talk about, so they kind of phrase it a little cryptically or whatever and all that. Could people make the same assumptions of our site? Like, what have we heard that we can't talk about?
Well, we used to post rumors that were based on those things that we had heard, but I think our industry sources have dried up a lot, and
yes,
and in general,
exactly.
There's not as much rumor mongering. There aren't as many leaks in the development
they've
side.
They've gotten a lot better
because
about it.
Yeah.
It's a big business now, and it just doesn't happen as much.
Well,
so
and obviously the propensity for leaks to sort of spread like wildfire these days is just so much greater.
Right.
If there were
and
just the way that developers sort of relate with the media in general has changed. There's a lot more direct interaction with the fans. Yeah.
Nintendo is totally clammed up too.
And announcements come less from these big events now. So it used to be that publishers would hold their announcements for a big event, but now they're more willing to make them outside of the event. But that meant they're holding these announcements back even though they've reached a point where it's ready to be announced. So there's a longer amount of time between when it's announced and when it's gained its, I don't want to say public knowledge.
That's a great point, James. I mean, they used to clench their fists a lot more tightly and hold everything until E3, for instance. And when you do that, it's more likely that things will leak out.
Right.
But now that they're leaking things out, dribbling. I mean, they're announcing a Dead Space game in February.
Yeah, February. You know? We used to never get announcements in February.
Yeah. And I think the thing is, I think you can attribute that entirely to the rise of blogs and the rise of the internet and just the rise of all kinds of networking stuff,
right.
Like Twitter and all that. I mean, now one of the best places they're locking down on dev people and publisher people twittering, because what's happening is people are actually leaking stuff on Twitter, and they don't really know who's following them, so it just kind of gets out.
Well, and not just that, because let's say you're on a social networking site, you can let something slip that may not really tell the whole story, but put together with other people they know you're working with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have a lot, the internet's got a lot of people looking at it versus before when it was just magazines or a select few websites.
Well, I mean, a perfect example is the DSi pictures that were posted before the DSi's release date was even announced. I mean, you're looking on a NeoGAF thread, and this is before Nintendo has even announced anything. and you're already seeing the product unboxed sitting on somebody's desk. And it's right. like, okay, so you're telling me that it's supposed to be shipping sometime this year, we don't know when, but yet there's a completely perfectly set up retail boxed, you know, DSi sitting there on somebody's desk. That's probably coming pretty soon.
And I think another issue that plays into it is that we lost, you know, we don't have Billy here anymore. And Billy had a lot of contacts. I mean,
yeah,
he had more than I ever did, for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Billy's cat wrote those articles. Exceptionally.
Yeah, well, I mean, Max Lake and I wrote some of those articles, too.
No.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, I know. First off, we don't have the same reputation or prestige we had at one point, because we were the biggest Nintendo-centric non-corporate site out there.
Yeah, for years we were.
It's meant that we had, you know, more contacts, too.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, publishers needed us more back then, because they didn't nobody had really harnessed the kind of networking power of the internet in terms of getting marketing out and stuff like that.
Okay, Plugabugs writes, if a developer contracted NWR crew...
There's other questions.
Oh, about the pictures?
Yeah.
It's not that hard to find photos of me on the internet.
No, me either. It's not that hard to find photos of John, because he's posted them in the message boards.
Yeah. I've been writing about Nintendo for 10 years. I've been to E3 8 or 9 times.
And
will find photos of me if you really want to. There are photos on our website of me almost touching a DS touchscreen with my tongue.
That's
there's also there's one of you holding a whip.
Oh yeah, with there's
actually
the
photos of
guy.
Pale Mike Gammon on IGN in his bucket hat, which I remember was it the Nintendo event before the Wii came out, like a month ahead of time, and he up in New York, and somehow or another IGN got the poster.
I remember
early, and our forums found his bucket hat and went nuts.
So. There you go. They're out there. I don't know if we'll add photos to our profiles. I doubt it.
Some people
don't want to be seen, you know? Mm-hmm. That's their right. That's their prerogative.
And I'll update my profile sometime in the next couple days, but really, I mean, there's not a whole lot. We don't have a lot of blanks on there, you know?
I think most of us probably could stand to update our profiles, our staff profiles.
Yeah, but I mean, I didn't feel like a lot of it was terribly relevant.
Yeah, it's more just the games you're playing now. It's just such a shame you didn't get to put Mystery Dungeon on there and then not update it after that.
Yeah, that's too bad.
I just think that would have been a lovely sort of, like, frozen in time, like when James stopped caring.
Games I'm playing now actually said, Miami Nights.
The day the music died.
Miami Nights, or maybe that was it. Maybe that was the moment frozen in time.
You know, I've been trying to pinpoint it, Greg, and you know, I'm going to track that lead.
So what was the point you stopped caring, John?
1987.
He was already 32 at that point.
I was 5.
I don't like this line of questioning.
Hey, Plugabugs writes, if a developer contracted the NWR crew to come up with an idea and would create it exactly how you wanted and would have unlimited resources to do so, but only had 60 seconds to collectively decide on something, what would you do? We have 60 seconds, guys.
I'd tell them that Carl had a really great idea to plagiarize Sin and Punishment.
Beautiful.
And that's my idea for a game.
So Sin and Punishment is your idea for a game.
That was Carl's idea for a game.
Does anyone remember
that's right.
I remember.
Yes.
I remember.
It was basically like, so yeah, what kind of game would you like to call describe Sin and Punishment without knowing what he was doing?
I was like, Carl, it's your lucky day.
This game already exists.
That's right.
I think what we need is a game starring an alien who is a master of fishing. And he fishes for all kinds of strange fish, from volcano lakes to ice lakes. And it needs to be Weaver.
Pokemon RPG with online voice chat and seamless friend tracking. And that wouldn't be my ideal game, but I think that makes the most sense.
John, Man Beam?
Massively multiplayer Wii Fit. Massively multiplayer online Wii Fit.
Fast,
I kind of like that. Wow. For me, honestly, how about a 2D Metroid for DS?
Yes, thank you. That doesn't take anywhere near 60 seconds to say, but it's bloody good.
There you
idea.
Go. That's what I want to play from Nintendo more than
how about a 3D Mario game for the DS? That's not Mario 64.
A new one?
Yeah.
That would be cool. That would be very cool. I mean, Mario 64 ran perfectly well on the DS, and they could do a lot more with it.
Controlling kind of weird.
Yeah, and that's the main thing. It's hard to do like a 3D action, third-person platformer type thing on the DS because of the control scheme.
Yeah, but, you know, I think people will figure it out.
Any flavor of Mario Party? Give me some more Mario Party.
Radical.
John is now officially reviewing every Mario Party game that comes out.
John's very easily pleased.
Animal Crossing DSi. Give me Animal Crossing DSi.
Even if the title of the game is Mario Party, this game blows. John,
you know what?
John is now stuck reviewing it.
Let me make a little tweak that'll blow your mind. How about an online Mario Party? Now that I could get behind. I would buy that. Yeah. I seriously would buy that.
Maybe that's why there hasn't been a Mario Party 9 yet, just because someone said, I really think we should do online with this. Fine, the series is boxed.
That's a great
idea.
We're
boxing your line.
Yeah.
How about anything decent in 2009 that uses WeSpeak? You know, I don't think they're going to give us Nintendogs where you use WeSpeak to give the dog commands, although they should.
Bite me.
But
yeah, I mean, I still think what you really need with that, obviously, is a co-op game. You know, more co-op games.
How about a massively multiplayer?
Endless Ocean 2 could be that to some extent, but obviously it's not very intricate co-op. So, like I've said it many times, Pikmin co-op would be so great.
Pikmin 3 will have that. Yeah,
because one of my favorite things about Pikmin 2, you know, we talk about the sort of improvements, the change in Pikmin 2, was the kind of almost the co-op element with yourself in terms of right, you know, you've got Olimar and Louie,
right,
and it's like I'll take a little one squad of one type of Pikmin over here with Louie, and then I'll have one with Olimar, and then you know you would start the attack with one, and then switch to the other and do that. If you could actually do that with a friend.
How about actually communicate
in real time with WeSpeak, that could just be so much fun.
How about a massively multiplayer online cooking training game? So you can get all your ingredients and you can discuss with people. Hey, I need help finding celery. Where can I find some?
I still really want to see a DS online game that actually makes use of the fact that it's portable. That combines online functionality with portability in the way that's like the iPhone. A lot of iPhone apps do this, and the DS is fully capable, and no one's ever done it. I'd like to see a game that actually makes me want to take my DS out with me to places that I normally wouldn't go to play it. You know, like something that makes me think creatively, like something location based. I think as much as people make fun of Boktai. For one thing, Boktai is a great game. Actually, that would be good for Retroactive, but it's a really good game, gimmick aside. And certainly the Sun Sensor is a total gimmick. It's cheesy. It doesn't work all that well. I have a lot of problems with it, but I like the concept of getting you to take your portable system outside. I like the idea that it's trying to get you to play your game in a different kind of place than you normally would. I mean, I can remember the summer that I got the first Boktai, I was out playing it by the swimming pool. And, you know, it was crazy. But that's the only place I could get enough sunlight to do it in the afternoon. And I just really like that idea. I think it's very provocative, and there's a lot more you could do with it that hasn't been done. Not just the Sun Sensor, but a lot of ways you could
Boktai
do it. Okay, well, that's listener mail. And now we move into news discussion. Greg put together a great list of news stories. Actually, one, Greg, I'm going to add it on to the front here that you didn't put on here. We have very overt signals from Nintendo of America that Commodore 64 support is soon to be added
to the U.S.
So virtual
riddle,
console.
That they put into the weekly update press release, of course.
Right. John, I'm guessing you had a Commodore 64 at some point.
Oh, yes, I did, my man. Yes, I did.
I guess correctly.
Yeah,
So is this something you can get excited about?
Yes, it is something I can get excited about, Johnny.
He bought one right out of college.
And what games are you looking forward to? Can you name any games that are like really highly desirable?
The ones I would like to see... Stop, James. Just stop.
If you can't name a game, I'm going to start laughing.
Well, I don't need tons of games.
James, you're about to get fired.
I'd like to see, like, California games. I'm sure they'll come out with...
I think that's on the European. There's a number of those game series. One came out tonight called Winter Games, for instance.
Winter Games?
Yeah, all those Epic games.
Yeah,
Epic games.
I played those for NES, though.
Yeah, I always liked them more. I never liked the NES ones, just because I don't know. Those games are kind of too primitive, simple. I guess you could say. Yeah, to really, I always thought it was kind of overdone to have them out on the NES. But I mean, like all of the old Epics games are really fun. Like Winter Games, Summer Games, Summer Games 2, California Games. I'm sure they'll bring over Impossible Mission or Impossible Mission.
That's also on the European. Some of the other ones on the European, The Last Ninja.
Last Ninja, that's really good, actually. That's a really good game.
You've got International Karate and International Karate Plus.
Crap.
That's on DS.
That many. I think there's only in the teens nearly a year.
Didn't they do like a big glut of them at first and then kind of push them aside for a while?
Well, like I said, it's never been a ton. It's gone through lulls. I mean, it has. It has gone through...
Like Neo Geo, too.
Yeah, I mean, Neo Geo's... Right, it seems like it's been abandoned.
It's
I mean, there hasn't been
it?
One in
I mean,
Japan since October.
The games are completely not worth the price that they ask for. That's the problem. So, Greg, in the year that that C64 games have been available to you, have you purchased any?
No, I mean there's just no like context for me. I didn't have one. I didn't know people had one. You know, you can read reviews and things, but it just doesn't. I'm not compelled. But especially 500 points, I think that's too much.
That is ridiculous.
Seems a bit.
What John's talking about in terms of like, it seems like some of these games would be a bit primitive to have on the NES. Well, they're going to cost you the same as an NES game on the Virtual Console.
That sucks.
I think that's. Maybe they could have a different pricing strategy in America. I don't know.
I doubt it.
Because there are differences in pricing strategies across the territories.
I think,
for instance,
I don't think anything's going to lowball that 500 mark.
I know. Well, they said with Master System games that some of them might not cost 500, some of them would cost 400, but they never have. They've all been at 500.
Yeah.
Well, Genesis are 700 in Japan, right?
600, actually.
Yeah.
600,
Wow. Yeah, I've got loads of Genesis games. Awesome. I'm actually getting the points cheaper than European points, and then the Mega Drive games cost fewer points.
You're getting them for half price, pretty much.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome. But of course, Japan has this weird thing where different genres actually cost more. There's an RPG premium. Ocarina of Time is a 1,200 point game for some reason. There's some curiosities. The Japan's whole pricing structure is kind of... Oh, Smash Brothers is also 1,200.
Weird.
For being awesome.
We still don't have Smash Brothers in America.
I know, it's bound to happen.
It's the craziest thing.
But yeah, I mean... In terms of pricing, I wouldn't pay more than $2. I mean, these are a lot of games where, I mean, you can literally go anywhere on the web and download the game file, you know? I mean, it's not even, I mean, the thing is, that might end now that they're coming back on VC, but I mean, these things are so, I mean, they're not even like MAME ROMs. They're way easier to get than that. They're posted all over the place.
Okay, well, on to the next story. Dead Space Extraction. Very recently announced. This is, you know, we knew there was a Dead Space game coming to Wii, but we didn't know what it was. And a lot of people thought maybe some kind of downgraded port with added Wii controls, you know.
A la Dead Rising, chop till you drop.
Well, no, because you said, Johnny, when you've talked about Dead Space, it's a lot like RE4 in space. So
absolutely.
I suppose a lot of people were hoping for a kind of RE4 Wii Edition type gameplay, set in the Dead Space universe.
Absolutely. That's what I was hoping. I was hoping for an original game and not some kind of rejiggering of the first Dead Space, because I've already played that. So I was hoping for, you know, basically a sequel or maybe a semi-sequel to Dead Space that played in a similar way, but had Wii controls that were more like, you know, RE4 Wii Edition, or even something, you know, maybe they could come up with an even better idea. Mm-hmm. But instead, Dead Space Extraction is an on-rail shooter game that's basically like Umbrella Chronicles or House of the Dead Overkill or Dragon Quest Swords, almost. But, yeah, I mean, this seems to be... I mean, we don't know much about it beyond that. There's a trailer. It doesn't really tell you anything about gameplay. It is all from first-person perspective. It does appear that you don't really have control over where you're walking, so it is sort of on rails, like these other games. And, you know, there may be more to it. There may be a lot of twists to that that we don't know about, but that does appear to be the case, and it's really quite a popular trend on the Wii to take these established franchises, and instead of making a sequel or making a new game that, you know, in sort of the same vein as the rest of the franchise, but, you know, with maybe some different controls, it seems quite popular to, like, really create something totally different from the franchise on Wii, and usually that something totally different is a lot simpler, especially if you look out at things like Soul Calibur Legends and Castlevania Judgment. These are, you know, I don't know. I don't want to be too negative on this.
I mean, the examples is more closely related to, like, Umbrella Chronicles and House of the Dead Overkill are a bit more positive than those, I suppose.
Right.
But there is the issue of the fact that those games already exist.
Exactly.
So I think there was a greater hunger for something more in the vein of an RE4 Wii edition, but original. Certainly, but I mean, there's a few things with this. I mean, one thing I think maybe about the on rails and the first person, all that is, that may be the only way that they can generate graphics that actually are somewhat reasonably evocative of the Dead Space sort of universe more on Wii. You know, if you could control what people are seeing at all times, and obviously you're not having a character model on the screen all times, that's stripping it down a bit, and it just makes it a bit easier to create visuals that actually look pretty good on Wii. I think that may have motivated it quite a lot.
Sure. Well, and it certainly simplifies camera control when you have a first-person game, but, you know, you could say the same for first-person shooters. This is not a first-person shooter. It is a a light gun game.
But, you know, if you've got something where literally every move is controlled, you know, it's on rails, it's like a theme park ride, you know, and every move is controlled, that must simplify things in terms of the graphics.
Oh,
and therefore you can have more detail, more effects and things, because it's not so complicated, because there's no real possibilities. You go through sort of parade.
Very much so.
I guess the thing I would say about this that's somewhat kind of, I mean, I don't know, you played Umbrella Chronicles, you could tell me, but obviously a lot of these on-rail shooters have their roots in the arcade, and you can't really be genuinely scary in the arcade. You know, it's too
It's a public place.
Yeah. It's too open a setting, there's loads of other noise going on or whatever, you know, it's just not going to happen. But like with a home game, you know, obviously with it being from a first-person perspective and stuff, I mean, I guess a lot of it would be sort of like those scary theme park rides, or what Scott Sharkey calls the spring-loaded cat moments. But, you know, you could actually make something that was, like, legitimately scary in this genre. And I guess that's kind of what I would hope for it. It's like, obviously, Overkill doesn't go for legitimately scary at all. It goes for the funny grindhouse kind of, you know, vein or whatever. So, I mean, Umbrella Chronicles, was that at all, like, scary?
There's a lot of things jumping out of frame at you, you know.
So it's just the spring-loaded cat stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it's not that creepy in terms of atmosphere. I think Dead Space is what, that's what Dead Space really does well, is the creepy atmosphere thing. I'm not sure how they can do that in an on-rails game, because really the reason Dead Space works as well as it does in terms of being kind of unsettling is that you are in control. And what you find is that you're walking down a hallway more slowly than you have to, because you don't want to turn around the corner and there'd be something bad. Or because you're low on life, you're low on ammo, and you're concerned about your survival, and you're trying to take it slow and be cautious until you can get back to a save point. So those elements are, I don't see any way they can really translate that to a rail shooter. And so I think that, you know, in terms of atmosphere, to me it's going to be less effective in an automatic type of game like this, you know? I don't know, we'll see. I mean, I don't want to be really negative on it, because I am looking forward to it. I like Dead Space. I like light gun games. I like these shooter kind of games. it's probably, you know, it's not the kind of game that I buy because I don't really feel like I get a very good value out of them.
I don't know. I'd just like to see for once, just, you know, just bring across something straight. Don't try to do something weird to it. Just make it.
Well,
just,
I mean, that's basically, you know, what they've done with Dead Rising, and it could not be less interesting.
Well, yeah,
and
but
nobody gives a fuck about Dead Rising
true,
for me right now.
True.
And it comes out in like a week.
But
nobody's talking about it.
Yeah,
it looks like shit.
Exactly. It looks like shit though, but look at what type of game that is. I mean, all of that game's gameplay is based on having as many zombies on the screen as you possibly can. I mean, it goes completely against the Wii's hardware. It's just not designed.
Yeah.
It was not designed with the Wii in mind, and therefore on the Wii, it's going to look like shit. Because if you try to recreate what's done on the 360,
well, but that is the problem with bringing over things straight, is that they're not designed with the Wii in mind. Now, I'll agree that there are probably candidates that are less intrinsically difficult than Dead Rising,
yeah.
and as we kind of talked about in terms of the relative sort of success of RE4 Wii Edition, you might think something that's kind of fundamentally similar to RE4 would be a better candidate, and I think that's why there is such disappointment around. But it's always a problem. Although this is being developed apparently at least in collaboration with the original Dead Space team. I mean, obviously because it is a different kind of game, they could easily have completely farmed it out to someone who just does these sorts of games. But apparently it's been developed with the Dead Space team and Euracom, who you might remember developed the World Is Not Enough first-person shooter game for N64.
Yeah, that's the only thing I could think of. They've made a lot of games, but
I'm sure
nothing super, super notable. And I can't think of anything recent that they made.
No, I can't either.
But they've been around for a long time.
Yeah, well, that was like, what, 10 years ago? Just that virtually.
Right. Yeah. So I'm not aware of their recent pedigree. I really, that doesn't mean very much to me that they're involved. I don't know what to think. I didn't want a watered down port of Dead Space. I didn't think that would work well. I think it would be kind of a disgrace to the original. And I don't think it would add anything to the series. You know, it would let people who only have a Wii play Dead Space, which is kind of the idea with Dead Rising. But I don't think that's a terribly good reason for a product to exist, you know.
Doesn't seem necessarily commercially viable either.
No, I don't think so. So what I was hoping is for basically a sequel, you know, maybe not Dead Space 2, but Dead Space 1.5 or whatever you want, Dead Space Gaiden or whatever you want to call it, but basically a sequel to Dead Space designed for Wii. So
yeah,
it wouldn't have to look exactly like the original, and we wouldn't have to be disappointed when it didn't. Right?
Mm-hmm.
But it could carry over the same style of gameplay, which I think is perfectly well suited to Wii. Perfectly doable with the controls, as has already been proven. I just think it's strange that Resident Evil 4 Wii Edition came out a year and a half ago, sold 1.5 million copies, and yet we still, to this day, have not seen a single game try to replicate its success. We haven't seen a single game from any company, including Capcom, in the same style of gameplay to present the same scope, the length, you know.
Yeah,
it's pretty baffling. It drives me nuts. It's such a success story, and yet everyone's ignoring it.
Yep.
And they think
It's easy for the other companies to say, well, you know, but that's a game that sold 3.5 to 4 million copies on other systems, and it's a big brand and all that, so, you know, it's not just about the gameplay, well, it works on Wii, you know, if you haven't got that to back it up, maybe it's still not going to sell. But of course, Capcom, they could have done it, but they haven't.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's very strange that Capcom has not announced a new Resident Evil for Wii.
They will.
I think they will, but
they're taking their time, and there's a big gap where another company could have stepped in, and they haven't.
The thing about RE4 is it's underpinned by a tremendously long and arduous development process that went into it, where the game was scrapped and all that.
Sure.
You know, and you wonder whether any Wii game would ever go through that kind of developmental rigor out of Capcom at this point. I mean, what they've done hasn't necessarily, apart from Zack and Wiki, hasn't necessarily inspired confidence in what they're willing to do with Wii.
Yeah.
They've published a lot of games, but they haven't developed a lot of games for it.
Right. All right, well, I think we need to move on to the next story. The DSi has been announced for, well, basically everywhere outside of Japan. It's coming in North America on April 5th for $170, and so is Rhythm Heaven that same day. I'm so glad we finally got a release date for Rhythm Head.
It's almost a year later.
Yeah, almost a year.
I think it's 9 months. I think nine months. I think is the cap. That's. Yeah. I was getting worried that they were going to like completely change the music or something, and that's why it was taking so long. But it's nothing. I think they're just changing the lyrics or whatever. It's not anything fundamental.
Well, the DSi is coming out in Europe on April 3rd. Price unconfirmed, but Greg says it's looking about 150 quid in the UK.
Yeah, the Times in London's got it at 14999, and that's pretty solid.
A well-renowned publication.
Yeah, and that's high. That is high. That is about £50 more than the DS Lite, and just £30 short of a Wii. And about the same price as a Xbox 360 arcade. Actually,
that's crazy.
I mean, so that's pretty amazing. I think that's the correcting for the strengthening of the yen there, because obviously the prices that they set the DS Lite at and the Wii at was a few years ago before the yen strengthened so much, and so they're kind of trying it. So they've been kind of getting hosed recently, and I think this is their making up for that basically.
We'll see if they actually make up for it with sales.
That is, I mean, when it is that is so hard, you know, when it is literally the same as a 360, even though it is the diminished arcade SKU, that's so close to the Wii as well. I think that's quite remarkable. $170 in the US. Now that's what, like a $40 premium, is it?
Yeah, it's the same price as a PSP, basically.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I think there might actually be one version of the PSP that's less than that.
See, that is not nearly the same kind of premium in relative terms, is it?
Right.
Not nearly.
Mm-hmm. Right. But, I mean, do you guys feel like, you know, Nintendo might be almost taking, like, a Sony PS3 kind of approach to this? I mean, it could the DSi end up being a failure because it was priced way out of proportion with everything else?
No.
Not now.
Well, I mean, what we've got to go on so far is in Japan, I think the differential is pretty similar to America or more, and it's done great guns. No problem whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's a bit of a tougher sell in America, actually.
To me, it still feels like a Game Boy Micro. It costs too much for what it does.
Yeah, I mean, the difference is the fact that it does have more unique functionality and the prospect for actual unique software as far as games go. And that's it's going to get interesting. How hard do they want to push the DSiWare angle to get people to buy this? You know, to get gamers to buy it first and foremost in some ways, you know, because there may be a certain amount of people that, you know, they're still selling so many DS Lites that so presumably there's going to be the, you know, future people who are going to buy a DS will just say, oh, I'll just buy the newer one, you know, mm-hmm. the better one.
Yeah, I don't think you should underestimate the amount of people out there that still have a DS Fat that just never bothered getting anything else.
Yeah, there's that too. So, but in terms of encouraging the sort of core players that have got a DS Lite that are generally happy with their DS Lite to actually upgrade, which is in itself a pretty big market, then they won't ignore it. It's the DSiWare angle that's probably going to be the biggest in. And they've been more proactive with it in Japan, but I wonder whether they're really going to prepare something quite big. I mean, if you could imagine, like, maybe a sort of new Super Mario Brothers type game, but that's downloadable or something like that. You know,
that'd be smart.
Do they need? Mm-hmm. Do they need something like that as well? I mean,
They do to get me to buy it. What I've said in the forums about this announcement is, first off, it's a very hard sell to get me to pay a lot more money to buy a system so that I can spend a lot more money to download games for it.
Yeah,
I mean,
sure.
You could say that about any system launch, except the difference here is I basically already own the system. So you're asking mm-hmm. me to buy it again for the added functionality of being able to buy more games for it. And that is pretty difficult for me to get over in terms of a logical barrier.
Well, you need some sort of substantial indication that there's going to be a sufficient quantity and quality of games.
I need multiple killer apps for DSi.
That's actually good. So it's like an investment, and the quantity quality of the downloadable titles would actually pay that investment off.
Yeah, and if WiiWare is the model, then no.
Yeah, exactly.
So far,
the WiiWare precedent is actually quite a poor one. But there are signs in Japan that that's not, you know, that they are going to kind of break away from that a bit. But there is also in the press release the mention that the quote unquote is able to play specific retail games. It's just interesting that they basically seems like they're leaving it open for specific DSi games to that aren't DSiWare. But at the same time, the way they just say able, it's like they're not saying there will be. They kind of just say
it's a possibility.
There might be. Yeah,
it's almost like a threat.
Yeah, like
maybe they will do if it gets successful enough, or I suppose maybe if third parties want to, they could release one. But I sense that Nintendo mostly wants to go with the downloadable angle as for DSi specific.
Yeah, and Greg, you have on here that there's no word on when the DSi shop will launch, but actually the Australian announcement, which has
which is April 2nd for the system, right? Which
and it says the DSiWare will be available at launch. So I think you can assume that will be the case in all the regions.
The European and American press releases didn't make mention of either of those.
So they're a little more loose-lipped over there, but if that's not just a typo or a mistake, if that is actually true, I'm sure you can assume it'll be available in all the regions by then.
Yeah. You have to think that it would be, which is different from Japan. I think it was the better part of a month or so, or certainly a few weeks.
Yeah.
Between the two.
Well, we need to move on to the next story. This is Project Sora. It's a new company founded by Nintendo Company Limited, or basically Nintendo Japan, and Masahiro Sakurai, who we were talking about recently.
Sora, it's Project Sora.
Yeah. It's a little confusing.
Nice naming there, guys.
So it's like his studio that already exists that he made when he split off from HAL is called Sora Limited.
Right.
But now he's made a new company
called Project Sora. What do you want to bet? What do you want to bet the employees completely overlap?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's quite strange, but yeah, so this is majority owned by Nintendo. And basically, they've signed up Sakurai essentially.
So it's a second party studio. It's the first time in a very long time that Nintendo has picked up a second party studio. I think the last one they picked up was Monolith Soft, which that hasn't worked out very well so far. They made Disaster. this we don't really know what Project Sora is working on, but it's not Smash Brothers and.
It's sounding like from the comments they've made, it's going to be something very different. Sounds almost experimental. I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm kind of scared. Mm. I'm intrigued, but also kind of scared.
I guess the question is like, what do you think Sakurai wants to work on?
I think that's what it comes down to.
He worked on Meteos.
Good
it's pretty weird.
I think Project Sora exists because Sakurai wants to work on Nintendo systems, but I don't think Nintendo wanted to let him basically go without oversight. So they created.
No, I don't think he wanted to work for Nintendo specifically.
Right. I think he wanted to. I think he was just more comfortable developing on their hardware.
He's probably had some sort of pet project that he's always wanted to do, and now that Brawl was such a success, he was like, "All right, look, throw me a bone here, $2 million
It's an 80-hour side-scrolling RPG action game called The Subspace Emissary.
I think what ended up happening was this is like basically a shell game, and this company exists, and Nintendo can overview everything he does, but he can still say, I don't work.
Yeah, you're probably right. And I wonder also if Doshin no Kirby comes out this year, it's Doshin no Kirby, right? Kirby's Adventure,
Hoshi no Kirby.
You
think Doshin the Giant or something?
I'm getting two things mixed up here. Yeah, but if Kirby's Adventure, the game that was announced as of, I think, 2004 for GameCube and delayed ever since, if that actually comes out this fall, I wonder if Sakurai will take two looks at it and say, you know what, I quit. because supposedly he left HAL in the first place because he hated what they were doing with the Kirby games.
Yeah, I'm not
sure.
Yeah,
and they were being too, they were milking it too much and something, wasn't it? But yeah. I mean, I guess that's the thing though. That probably is the big thing here, is that it's for Sakurai perhaps, is that he's got some of the resources, obviously, of Nintendo, be, you know, the collaborative kind of thing, but maybe he's just got more creative control because it's
access to their franchises if he wants.
He's got all of the a lot of the pluses of working with Nintendo that he would have had when he was at HAL, but probably a little more autonomy. So I could see it from his point of view, and ostensibly it's going to be something more core focused. You know, Iwata said it's going to be something that is going to be something different, and that there's something that hardcore gamers will want. So I don't know whether that means that it's, you know, going to be specifically for them, or it's going to be something that tries to straddle, you know, all the groups a bit. But, I mean, it's interesting. I presume, considering they're forming the company now, that the fruits of this union will be quite far off.
Yeah, probably. But it's going to be really interesting to see what comes out of it. All right, well, the last story we have is that X-Square Enix designer Yasumi Matsuno has been working on the story for Mad World, Sega and Platinum Games. Matsuno was veteran of Ogre Battle, Final Fantasy Tactics, Vagrant Story, and Final Fantasy XII.
So he actually came over to... I believe he came over to Square when Square bought the company that made Ogre Battle series.
Right.
To get rid of competition.
The company was called Quest, right?
Because basically Square had... Square liked the Ogre Battle series, but they liked... They didn't
that
like...
They killed it?
They didn't like that it was taking away from their games, so they bought it and forced the staff to make Final Fantasy Tactics games.
Yeah.
And then they laid them off. Nice job, Square.
But yeah, he was really, really important sort of figure in a lot of these games. I think he directed like the Ogre Battle games, Final Fantasy Tactics, Vagrant Story, and he was a key component in Final Fantasy XII before he resigned.
Yeah, he quit during the development of 12,
I think,
right?
It's supposedly for health reasons, or, you know, it was kind of vague.
Yeah,
but,
well...
Yeah, that was the end
exhaustion.
Of exhaustion.
Yeah.
Yeah, quite possibly.
He had to cancel the tour for exhaustion.
Well, word has it a lot of the former Quest employees were never really happy after the buyout.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they felt like their hands were too tied behind their back by Square.
As is typical.
It's an interesting transition to go from being, you know, thoroughly, thoroughly steeped in these, you know, sort of fantasy RPGs kind of components where he would actually create the scenarios for these games in addition to designing them in large part. But to Mad World, which is, you know, it's the Running Man, it's Escape from New York, it's, you know... It's
incredibly violent compared to anything he's done before.
Sort of totally Western sort of inspired, and like you said, violent, deliberately crass with the announcers, the kind of thing floating around. That he's actually sort of created the story as that if you want to take an optimistic slant, I just kind of hope that there's a bit of a kind of a depth of black comedy to Mad World, sort of vulgar cult qualities rather than just being vulgar.
Yeah,
you know what I mean.
I think that comes back to what we were discussing, I don't know, was it a couple weeks ago now? Where we talked about whether or not we'd want the game to just be a bloodbath.
Yeah, you brought up the point that, you know, these games that are ultra-violent, you almost don't want them to do well because it sort of casts a poor light on games.
Right, and it sort of encourages future sorts of behavior in that way in game design.
Yeah, but I just hope that it kind of, that the fact that he drafted in this person that's got this kind of really, you know, really impressive resume. I mean, you're talking,
right. I mean,
you know, multiple perfect scores from Famitsu on that list.
Yeah, he has
Vagrant Story and 12, right? This is, you know, as sort of steeped as one could have.
He's also got the number 7 game when Famitsu did their 06 100 all-time favorite games. He has number 7. Tactics Ogre, Let Us Cling Together.
So, okay, a couple things. First, this is one of these weird does-not-compute pairings, like when you found out that Game Arts was working on Brawl.
See,
just like, really?
See,
really?
I think this one computes more because he's doing story and concept here, but, you know, he's already created games that have... I think he did story and concept for Ogre Battle 64, which probably had 100 auxiliary characters that weren't related to you, but they all had backstories, they all had relationships.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, from what we know so far of Mad World, it has nothing to do with anything this guy has ever written before.
Yeah.
So I it's going to be really interesting to see if maybe if there's another layer behind the gory action of Mad World. That
the thing about
know,
Mad World is it seems pretty kind of derivative in the sense that it's visually it's Sin City, and plot-wise it's Running Man. And
you would think its story would be an afterthought for the
moment. Exactly, and then you're talking about drafting in one of the most renowned people in that area to actually work on it.
He's a writer.
Right. We're just wondering, like, what the hell could he be writing for Mad World? It's a strange combination.
Just because he hasn't written a game like this before, we know he's a capable writer.
Oh, sure, but so, I think what I'm talking about is the fact that the people at Platinum would actually feel it necessary or think it would be cool for him to do that, he could really add something.
He's apparently very close friends with Matsuno.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, sure. I'm sure the networking aspect is a big part of how this can happen.
Sorry,
but,
he's close friends with Inaba. Sure.
But what interests me is just the idea that, even though you're making this game that's very visceral, that's kind of the point of the game, that there is some, at least on some level, some additional ambition to make it more interesting. And because one thing about Mad World, it looks cool and all that, but you just wonder, in any sense, whether it's the gameplay or the scenarios, there's going to be depth to keep you engaged. And maybe this is a positive sign in that aspect.
One last question. Does anyone know if Richard Dawson is still alive? Because if so, he should be the final boss of Mad World.
He is. Actually, it's funny
still alive.
Yes, it's funny that you should ask that, because over the weekend, I was watching a marathon of Family Feud, which, of course, who is the man on Family Feud? Dawson himself.
Who's the man who kisses all the chicks?
Dude, it's funny, man. If I could make a total aside, if you watch those old shows, women were throwing their panties at that guy. It's ridiculous. Women flat out flirt with him. I mean, they sit there and they like grab his head and kiss him and stuff. It's weird. It's kind of creepy to watch, actually.
Yeah.
But yes, he is still alive.
He's the fucking man, is what he is.
He is the man for sure.
Platinum. It might be one of the most amazing collections of talent that's ever been assembled in the gaming industry. I mean, you have Inaba, Mikami, Kamiya, and Ueda all working under one company as full-time employees.
Back of the box material from James Jones.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they unite to create someone that thrashes people with her hair.
With your powers combined, I am Captain Planet.
Bayonetta looks like God of War with
looks
guns
like garbage,
guns.
I think.
That's a whole other level of crass, isn't it?
It really is. It's a different kind. All right, guys, that's going to be the end of our show. And before we go, I just want to give one more request that you send in really interesting emails to us that we can read on the air and talk about. And once again, the address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Also, if you have a minute, it'd be wonderful if you could look us up on iTunes and leave a review. Give us a 5-star rating if you think we're a good show. That really helps us bring in new listeners, actually. So we'll be back next week. And until then, you can read us on nintendoworldreport.com. Bye.
Later.
See you soon. Attention to details, Lindemann.
All right,
John,
here we go.
Attentive controls, Lindemann.
Yep.
Oh, James.
John,
if everybody's
at the
ready,
fucking wheel, Lindemann.
Okay, here we go. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Did you hear the burp too?
That's a great way to start things off, isn't it?
I belched out the number 2 there.
So
this part's cut.
This
we
is a Radio
started.
Free Nintendo episode. Johnny's burping over here.
We haven't actually started yet.
We did start. You clapped.
I decide when we start.
Exactly.
Translation, this is going in.
I trust Greg.
That laugh.
Big mistake.
Yeah.
That laugh doomed this all.
I'm surprised James even makes it into most episodes with Greg editing it.
I'm surprised you actually sane enough to wind up in any episodes, John.
Hello, and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo, episode 134.